Hosea was a man who obeyed God. Now, let's move this down a wee bit. How's that? And he obeyed God. He obeyed this particular instruction, even though it was difficult to obey for four reasons that we gave you this morning. It was contrary to his understanding. It was contrary to his personal desires. It was contrary to his religious environment, and it was beyond his ability to fulfill it and to marry a woman like Gomer. And yet he did it. But you're not to go away with the idea that that was the first command that God ever gave to Hosea, nor that this is normal in the experience of a Christian. It may happen, but it is the unusual. Generally, God's commands are within the limits of our understanding. He has given you common sense, and you're supposed to use it. And you don't do the craziest thing that occurs to you, because it must be God's will if it's the most stupid thing imaginable. Little common sense is valuable. As one time that there was a student sneaking out of Cape Moray Hall one morning instead of being in lectures, and I happened to see that same student just as they were sneaking out, and I said, where are you going today? And they said, I went sort of pink, and they said, oh well, the Holy Spirit told me I had to go to such and such a store and to buy something. I said, really? I hope you both know that store's not open today. And it wasn't. And a little common sense, you know, it's not a bad thing to have every once in a while. And God will normally guide you along the lines of your common sense. Okay? It doesn't work this way that, you know, you wake up in the morning and God says, get up now. I mean, if you know breakfast is at 8 o'clock and you know you want to spend half an hour with the Lord before that, and you know that it's going to take you 15 minutes to get dressed and clean your teeth and wake up before you do that, then you get up at 7:15. You know, it's just common sense. You don't need a miracle, and you don't need a voice from heaven. You don't need a neon sign flashing on the ceiling just above your head. You just set your alarm, get up. It's called common sense. And you don't, having got out of bed, listen to God and he says, now walk 8 paces forwards, turn left, 5 paces, now in the bathroom, pick up your toothpaste tube. Good. Now turn the top to the left. Left, dummy. And said, you know how to take the top off your toothpaste. You know that if you're going to clean your teeth, you have to take the top off first. Most of you, anyway. And so you operate according to common sense. And you're supposed to use it. But God may overrule your understanding. And he's every right to do so. Then, God's will isn't always the very last thing that you would ever want to do. You know? Some folks think that way and hear them talk, you know, and you think, you know, if I'm going to marry the girl that God has in mind for me, I can just imagine what she'd be like. You know, she'd be a redhead. No hair, just a red head. And she'll have beautiful eyes, you know, especially the green one. And she'll have superb teeth so she can eat an apple through a tennis racket. And the one, if I marry the girl God's got in store, boy, she's going to be some monstrosity. And that is rubbish. You know, you don't walk into a store and buy the ugliest piece of clothing you can find on the store because it must be God's will. You know? You buy the one, if you can afford it, and you think you should afford it, that is the nicest looking, fits you best, suits you best, etc. And God's given you taste and desires, and it's not wrong to use them. You know? But God may overrule those desires. And always, strangely enough, when he overrules them, long term they'll be fulfilled in a far deeper way than you could have possibly anticipated. Because the will of God is absolutely tailor-made to your character and your personality. He knows everything there is to know about you. But obedience will involve sometimes obeying even though it's the last thing that you want to do. Sometimes. Then it was against Hosea's religious environment. But very, very often the commands of God come to us through, first of all, our parents. Second, through the state. Third, through the church. And God has set these structures. And he has set them for our protection. If there were no structure, life would be absolute chaos. But it would be. It would be terrible. Imagine if all of a sudden, in the middle of a larger city like Los Angeles, every single piece of traffic knowledge were to disappear from our heads. And every highway code and law concerning driving was to be burned up. You know, so suddenly we got no idea in our heads which side of the road we're supposed to drive on, what those red, yellow and green lights mean, and all those things. There are no rules, and it's every man for himself. Wouldn't it be interesting? See, rules are really for our benefit. We can't live without them. And it is God who raises up and puts down authorities and kings. And I was thrilled the other day. I was doing a study in Isaiah, and I found out that God told Isaiah the name of a man called Cyrus was going to set his people free. The only thing is, he told Isaiah about the same time as Hosea was prophesying, about 720 BC. And it was going to be 140 years later before Israel would go into slavery to Babylon. And then it was going to be 70 years after that, that's 210 years after, that the empire of Medo-Persia would arise, and the king Cyrus would come out as a strong one in the competition, and he would then defeat Babylon and set the people free. And there wasn't even an empire of Babylon at the time, much less was there a Medo-Persian empire in existence. And yet God told Isaiah all that time before that it was going to happen. And he knows, and he raises up kings and puts them down, authorities, things like that. And he's supreme throughout history. And we don't disobey the government unless there's a very, very specific reason directly from God for doing so. I'm a little bit concerned about the eagerness with which Christians read books like Brother Andrew. You see, it's a great story about this guy who goes smuggling Bibles into Russia and how God sort of shuts the eyes of the guards so they don't notice that he's got a million Bibles in the back of his truck. Oh, what a slight exaggeration. and don't misunderstand me. It's great that Brother Andrew did that. But lots of Christians think, oh, wouldn't it be great to do that? What an adventure. Man, we can defy the government. We can all be Christian smugglers. Superb. Because there is a kind of an instinct in us to want to disobey the law sometimes, you know. And nice to have a Christian reason to break the speed limit and things like that. And normally we obey the law of the land, we obey the instructions of our parents, we obey the authority of our church, unless we have a specific mandate from God which overrules that. And then, in the realm of our working within or beyond our own capacities, God will tell us to do things that we cannot do in ourselves. That's what the Christian life is about. It's always about doing things that we can't do. Like love your enemy. Did you ever try that? It's difficult, isn't it? How do you love your enemy? You hate the person. And he tells us to do that, and he makes available those resources. But normally, unless you've got a specific instruction from God, you operate within the limits of your resources. Otherwise, you're going to be in trouble, aren't you? So we must be prepared, as Hosea was prepared, to obey when God steps beyond those familiar limits. But he first of all, of course, learned to obey within those limits. And God gave him much smaller instructions, and Hosea learned obedience in a million little ways before he ever was tested in this way. And that's the problem sometimes, you know. You and I think, boy, if I had some big assignment to do, I would do it, but this niggling little discipline, you know, like some of the rules I've got around here and some of the things my parents put on me, all this kind of stuff, man, I can't live with that. I mean, if it was something big and adventurous like the evangelization of Africa, I'll go for that. These petty little things, who can be bothered with that? And yet it's really in areas like that that your obedience is really tested and decided. I want to hammer this home from a nice little passage in Joshua, if you turn there for a moment, Joshua chapter 5 and verse 13. Giving a warm welcome to our friends from Comfort back down there on the bench. Very nice to have you with us this evening. Awesome. Right, verse 13. Remember we gave a very, very fast survey in the first couple of lectures about the history leading up to Hosea's time. And how the children of Israel were really bored for 40 years while they were in the desert. They weren't supposed to be there. They were supposed to be in Canaan, the land of milk and honey, which was the place of God's plan for them. And the desert was a pretty miserable experience because they weren't in God's plans. They disobeyed. Well, now they've actually crossed the border. They've crossed the River Jordan, which is a border. They've got into Jericho. And having had their manna, their what is it for 40 years, they had a break from that. Verse 12. The manna stopped the day after they ate this food from the land. There was no longer any manna for the Israelites, but that year they ate of the produce of Canaan. Well, thank goodness for that. Now, when Joshua was near Jericho, he looked up and saw a man standing in front of him with a drawn sword in his hand. Joshua went up to him and asked, "Are you for us or for our enemies?" "Neither," he replied, "but as commander of the army of the Lord I have now come." Then Joshua fell face down to the ground in reverence and asked him, "What message does my Lord have for his servant?" The commander of the Lord's army replied, "Take off your sandals, for the place you're standing is holy." And Joshua did so. Now Jericho was tightly shut up because of the Israelites. No one went out and no one came in. Then the Lord said to Joshua, "See, I have delivered Jericho into your hands, along with its king and its fighting men." So finally they've crossed into the borders of Canaan. They have tasted the fruits of the land. And it's just as good as God said it would be. He didn't exaggerate at all. He never does. God isn't in the exaggerating business. When he talks about joy unspeakable and full of glory, and when he talks about peace that passes understanding, and when he talks about the love of Christ that passes knowledge, he's not exaggerating. This isn't just extravagant language. This is absolutely the way it is. God isn't in the exaggerating business. It's as good as he said. And now just actually tasting the good stuff in Canaan. But in front of them, there is a massive obstacle called Jericho. The walls of Jericho are about as wide as this building. There are houses built on top of them. And the gates are closed and the place is armed to the teeth. There are soldiers and weapons and huge rocks and cauldrons of boiling oil and stuff on top of the battlements, and it looks kind of formidable. And Joshua knows, and the whole of the people know, they've got to conquer Jericho if they're going to experience any more of the land of Canaan. They can't just bypass it and leave a garrison like that behind them. It would cut them off from their supply lines. They would be raided from the rear sometime when they're trying to face some other foreign front, and they'd be annihilated. They've got to deal with Jericho, but how to deal with it? And I wonder if tonight there's somebody here, and you're just on the threshold of a real Christian adventure. And you know that life in Jesus Christ can be an incredible adventure. As you move forward under His instructions, and you experience His power and His grace and His blessing in your life, and you know that it's there, and you know it's as good as God says, but there's this Jericho thing. And it's maybe a habit that you can't break. Or it's maybe that you've never really plucked together the courage to go and witness where it counts, where people are not Christians. Or it may be that you've never managed to discipline your life. And you know it has to be disciplined. And you know you have to get into the Word regularly. And you know you have to listen to what God is saying. And you know you have to do it. Or it may be a relationship. You know, you can never pretend that the Christian life is victorious unless you get a good relationship with those people. Maybe your parents. Maybe somebody back home. And you know that the life is all out there, but there's this thing in front of you, this Jericho. If you've got one, you know what it is. It's the thing God's got His finger on right now. And it mocks you. It's got these massive solid walls. How can you move it? How can you shake it? I mean, Joshua and this mob, they've got no weapons. And they've got no experience. And they're not trained soldiers. They're not an army. They're just 2 million refugees. Just come out of slavery. Never fought a battle in their lives. Well, what? So here they are. And Joshua is having a look at Jericho, and the more he looks at it, the more formidable it is. And the closer he gets, the more he realizes he can't deal with it. And as he's looking at it, he meets somebody, and he doesn't know who it is. We know, because it's obvious as you read on who it is, it's none other than Jesus Christ Himself. A few hundred years before He was born, but then He was from the beginning. In the beginning was the Word. The Word was with God. And He just appeared at this time to Joshua. You can tell it's Jesus because He demands worship. The angels don't do that. The angels forbid worship. You know, the one that John met on when he had his vision on Patmos and the Revelation, and John's going to worship him. The angel says, see, you don't do it. I'm a servant, as you're a servant. This is Jesus. But Joshua doesn't know. And he sees him, and he comes swaggering up to him, and he says, hey, whose side are you on? Our side or their side? And Jesus says, no. Reminds me of when I was a small boy, and my mother said, would you like to wash the dishes or dry them? No. There always has to be an alternative answer, you see. Are you on our side or their side? No. And we ought to get this very firmly fixed in our minds. You're listening. Jesus Christ is not on your side. You got that? Jesus Christ is not on your side. And He never will be. No, I'm not on your side. I am the commander of the armies of heaven. Whose side are you on? That's the relevant question. We know what Jesus Christ stands for, but He is not our servant. We're supposed to be His servant. Our business is not to twist the arm of a reluctant God and drag Him out of heaven and bring Him down into our will and into our desires and make Him do what we think He ought to do. That is not our business. Our business is to cooperate with Him in what he's doing. He's the commander. And Joshua was so relieved, boy, I am the commander of the armies of heaven. Well, great. I am so pleased to see. You see, I've got this little problem. It's called Jericho. As I've been doing with most problems, I've been having a look at Jericho, only the more closely I have a look at Jericho, the more worried I become, because I don't know how to deal with it. I don't even begin to know how to deal with it. I'm at my wit's end wondering how to deal with it. And since you're the commander, well, it's your responsibility, that's great. I'll quite happily submit to your authority as a commander. So tell me, what is your strategy for the conquest of Jericho? Do you want us to make battering rams and charge through the gates? We'll do it. Do you want us to sneak up in the middle of the night and dig little tunnels under the wall and come up inside the city? We'll do that. How about building ladders and training an Olympic quality sprint team, and we will race up to the walls, put the ladders up the walls, scramble up the ladders and over into the city? Or we can all take off our suspenders and we can link them all together, and we will make an Old Testament catapult, and we will put our Old Testament paratroops in there, and we will fire them over the walls into the city. How about that? What is your strategy for the conquest of Jericho? And what follows is the strategy of Jesus Christ for the conquest of Jericho. Take off your shoes. How on earth do you conquer a city by taking off your shoes? Well, it's very simple. First of all, you keep them on for a couple of weeks in the warm weather. And then you go upwind of the city, and then 2 million of you, on the sound of a trumpet blast, all together whip off the shoes, and they all run out screaming from the city and lay their arms down on the sand. I don't think that's what he meant by that. Here's what I do think he meant. See, the person who stood without shoes was a slave in the presence of his master. And what Jesus is saying to Joshua is this: Joshua, if you're serious, you know, if you really want to conquer Jericho, if you really want to go forward into the plans of God and occupy all that territory that you know he has for you, then we've got to get one thing straight right now, and that is the relationship that exists between you and me. I'm Lord, and you're slave. Take your shoes off. And the whole issue is decided right there. You see, taking off the shoes, Joshua probably knew how to take his shoes off by the time he was 9 months old. You don't have to be an intellectual. You don't have to be a superman. You don't have to have any special qualities to be able to take your shoes off. But in a way, it was the last thing that Joshua would want to do. You see, Joshua had just come to power. For 40 years, he had been second fiddle to Moses. And he had been the new commander for about a week. That was all. Moses had just died, and Joshua has been the new commander for about a week. And he is the head of state, and he's also the supreme commander of the forces of Israel. And it's a very distinguished position, and it's begun with victory. And they've come across the River Jordan, something Moses never managed. Great man though he was. Moses never made it into the promised land. Joshua took them there. And so here he is, and he's the new general, and he's the new hero, and he's got to go around looking like a slave. Not very, very impressive uniform for a general, is it? What are people going to say, Lord, if I go around looking like a slave? It's not going to inspire them with my exotic qualities as a commander, is it? And it was a very, very simple thing to do. I mean, taking your shoes off, you can do it in seconds. And it doesn't take any great qualities, and yet it was just the very last thing that Joshua wanted to do. And when you come to the Lord Jesus Christ and you say, Lord, I really mean business, and I really do want you to be Lord of my life, and I really do want to move on with you and occupy all the territory that you have for me. I want to enjoy your blessings and fulfill your program, and I want to be used by you, and I want to know you real in my life, etc. He says, okay, then here's what you do. And it's never some great heroic piece of service. It isn't. It's something really basic, like this. You insulted somebody last week. Remember? Go and tell them you're sorry. Go and put it right. You told a lie the other day, didn't you? Remember it? Just go back to that person and tell them the truth. And it's something just as easy as that. And you can do it in about 10 seconds. It doesn't take long to say, hey, I'm really sorry about last Wednesday. Does it? But it's the last thing you want to do. And it's right there that it's going to be decided whether or not Jesus Christ is Lord in reality, or whether you're still pleasing yourself. But if you're not prepared for Jesus Christ to be Lord, turn you back on Jericho and turn you back on the Promised Land and head back there into the desert and try and get excited about moving in evangelical circles and building Christian sandcastles. Because that's all you know. The very first principle of the Christian life is it is lived under the authority of Jesus Christ. And he's the commander, he's the Lord. You and I are the slaves. But you'll notice that while Jericho was still shut, and the walls were still intact, and the men were still surrounding those walls, when Joshua took his shoes off, the Lord said to him, look, I've given you Jericho. Because Jericho, while always a problem for you, is never a problem for him. It's quite easy. And the moment our relationship is right with Jesus Christ, Jericho is handed over on a plate. In fact, that's the principle of the book of Joshua. In the very first chapter, he says, every place that the sole of your foot treads on, that I have given you. Not every place your sandal treads, but every place the sole of your foot treads, it's yours already. That's the key to understanding the book of Joshua. Well, it's not got a lot to do with Hosea, or has it? Hosea, anyway, had learned the principle. And if we're going to be like him, then we have to learn it too. Okay, I want to go on a little bit and come back in the second lecture to the second great quality of Hosea's life, which won't fit into the 15 minutes we've got just now. So, verse 3 of Hosea chapter 1. So, Hosea married Gomer, daughter of Diblaim. Remember the double-hearted one? And she's a prostitute, but she conceived and bore him a son. And in that language, she conceived and bore him a son, there's a very strong suggestion that this child was actually Hosea's own child. You find that the other two children are not put like that. Verse 6, Gomer conceived again and gave birth to a daughter. And verse 8, after she had weaned Lo-Ruhamah, Gomer had another son. And with all still the suggestion it's got nothing to do with Hosea. But with this one, she bore him a son. And apparently this is Hosea's own son. It's nice that he got one child of his own anyway. And verse 4, then the Lord said to Hosea, call him Jezreel, because I will soon punish the house of Jehu for the massacre at Jezreel, and I will put an end to the kingdom of Israel. Jezreel means literally in the Hebrew, God sows, in the sense of God plants up the ground, buries him. And the name Jezreel was originally given to a valley, a very beautiful valley. It was very fertile. It was a place of vineyards. Lovely spot. And so it was called God Sows. It was like the garden of God. And that's why it had that name. And some pretty ugly things had taken place in that valley. And the person responsible was called Jehu. Jehu was a murderer, but he became king of Israel. And his dynasty was still ruling. Not Jehu himself, but his grandson, Jeroboam II, still on the throne. And there had never been any repentance for what had taken place at Jezreel. So God wants to remind them about Jezreel. It would be a little bit as though Dr. Billy Graham and his wife Ruth were to have a child now. You see, it would be a little bit unexpected. It's a long time since Mrs. Graham gave birth to any children, and she's a little bit old for it now. And it would be surprising. It would make the national news. In fact, it would make international medical history. And there would be a little TV interview, probably, and the interviewer would sit down with Billy Graham in a nice way that TV interviewers have in this nice little studio. It looks like it anyway. It's got no roof on it, it's got no ceiling, and it's only got two walls instead of four. And the others all TV cameras and rubbish, but it looks as though they're in a nice, cosy little room, and they're chatting. And the interviewer says to Billy Graham, well, tell me, Dr. Graham, what are you going to call your son? And he says, Watergate. And there's a sort of shock ripples through the nation. See, it would be as though, I'm not saying it is this way, but it would be as though the corruption that led up to Watergate was still being carried on throughout the government of this country, and that God was about to bring judgment on the country because of it. And although the people had conveniently tried to forget all about Watergate, God had not forgotten, and this was his way of reminding them. So it says, call his name Jezreel. And so Jezreel is the first child that Gomer bears, and the very name is a message, and it's a message about judgment. And it's not only that God remembers the events that have taken place at Jezreel, but that he is going to plow up the ground and he is going to bury the nation of Israel. He's going to plant them like seeds in the ground. They're going to disappear from off the face of the earth. And he did it. And then the next child, verse 6, Gomer conceived again and gave birth to a daughter. Then the Lord said to Hosea, call her Lo-Ruhamah, for I will no longer show love to the house of Israel, that I should at all
forgive them.
And the Hebrew word ruhama means one who receives, and now this is a very complex word. Probably the nearest we can get is a father's love and protection. It's translated in the King James mercy, and in the sense of the 17th century word mercy, it's a good translation. As far as modern English is concerned, we don't understand mercy quite the same way. Ruhama means one who receives a father's love and protection. Lo Ruhama means one who does not receive a father's love and protection. So this is the second child, and what God is saying about his people through the second child is this: you, my nation, who were my children, you will no longer receive my love and protection as your father. The family relationship has broken down. It's a very sad statement. You can see it in terms of Hosea saying this about the baby, because the baby's not his. And he said, I'm not going to take care of that child, Gomer. I'm not going to be responsible for it. I'm not going to love it as though it's my child. It's not. It's your child. You take care of it. But it was a message, it was a warning to the nation of Israel. Then the third child is called Lo Ami. Ami means my people. And Lo Ami means not my people. In other words, tell Israel that they are not my people. They're no longer mine. The old relationship that used to exist does not exist anymore. You see, that relationship was established on Mount Sinai. Mount Sinai, being a mountain 6,000 feet high, on the borders of Egypt. The people were given 2 days to set barricades around the whole of the base of the mountain, because they were not to go on there, and 2 days to wash themselves and their clothes. Not because they were particularly dirty, but because, not even because they were particularly slow either, but because they were to prepare themselves, not just physically, but more importantly, mentally, for this great occasion. And then God covered Sinai with a cloud. And Moses was summoned to climb 6,000 feet up Sinai. 6,000 feet is very high if you come from Winnipeg. the only way you get there is in an airplane. But Moses is 80 years old. I don't know how many of us are going mountaineering when we're 80. But if you're really going to serve God, it's not a bad idea to stay in reasonable physical shape. You never know what he's going to ask you to do. 80 years old, Moses climbed 6,000 feet up Sinai to meet with God. And God was shrouded in a cloud so that Moses didn't see his full glory. It's not because God is shy. God is not shy. I received a fairly unusual gift for Christmas. I was very excited about it. It was in a box about this long, and about this wide, and about this high. It was a telescope. And when I opened up the box, complete surprise, no idea what was inside it, the first thing I saw was a red card about this size. And on that card it said this: under no circumstances is this instrument to be pointed at the sun. Failure to observe this will result in permanent blindness. You see, the sun is vastly too bright for us to look at with a naked eye. It is filtered by several miles of atmosphere when it gets down here. And the light is scattered over a journey of 93 million miles. What the telescope does effectively is to bring you nearer to the sun, and it's far too much. Your eye can't stand it. And God veiled himself in a cloud for Moses' benefit. Not because God is shy, but because neither Moses nor anybody else could stand the full revelation. And Moses went 6,000 feet up to the top of Sinai. And when he got there, and arrived there panting slightly, you know what God said to him? Moses, go back down again. He did. Moses, you go back down again, you check round all those barricades, you warn the people, I'm not fooling around. And you make sure that nobody, no man, woman, child, no animal crosses a barricade. If it does, it's to be stoned to death. If you don't observe that, I'm going to break out in fire and judgment against your people. I'm a holy God, I'm not messing around. And so Moses, without even the suggestion of an argument, went right back down, right round the base of the mountain, warned the people, 6,000 feet back to the top of the mountain, and God gave him the law. And the old agreement was established on the basis of law. And they submitted themselves to the law, and they said, everything that God has said, we will do. And the old covenant, the old agreement, the old relationship was by rescue on God's part, rescuing them from Egypt, and generosity on his part, giving them the land of Canaan and his protection and his guidance, his provision, etc. And on their part, by faith and obedience expressed in observing the law. But the law always brings difficulty. Whenever there are laws, there are always several we agree with and one or two we don't agree with. Ever found that? There's always one or two that we don't like. And we don't bother to keep those because we think the others are all right. You know, we keep all the others, so forget those two. But even though the others, we agree with them in principle, there are always one or two we can't keep, even though we think they're a good law. We just can't keep them, that's all. And then living by a law becomes very frustrating. You ever notice that? Suppose I were to borrow Mr. Westbrook's car and I were to drive through San Antonio at 115 miles an hour. See, it's just possible the police would stop me. And they would say, you're driving at 115 miles an hour. And I say, yeah, isn't it fun? And they say, yes, but it's against the law. And I say, all right. Was I driving on the left-hand side or the right? And they say, you were driving on the right. So I say, you know, it's very gracious of me because the correct side to drive on is the left, the way we drive in England. And just for your benefit, I drove on the right. Isn't that nice of me? Not at 115 miles an hour. And I say, just a minute, did I knock down any old ladies? No, you did not knock down any old ladies. But 115 miles an hour is against the law. And I said, just a minute. Did I run through any red traffic lights? No, you did not run through any red traffic lights. 115 miles an hour is against the law. And I said, why must you be so picky? You know? Why can't you just say thank you to me for not knocking down any old ladies instead of blaming me because I happen to have exceeded the speed limit by a little bit? Did that ever happen to you? Did you ever have a policeman stop you and say, excuse me, I want to say thank you to you for driving on the proper side of the road today? Did you? The law doesn't work that way, does it? All the law does is condemn you when you break it. And so they got discouraged trying to keep the law. They not only got discouraged, they forgot all about it. And so the old agreement was broken. It was broken so many times, it didn't even exist anymore. It was in tatters. And so God says, look, I remember Jezreel. I will tell you what Jezreel's all about. It takes a long time. I remember Jezreel, you haven't dealt with it, so I'm going to bury you. Lo Ruhamah, I'm not going to have any more mercy upon you. The day of mercy is gone. Lo Ami, you're not my people anymore. You were my people, but no longer. You've broken the agreement. It doesn't exist. And so there's no protection, and there's no guidance, and there is no rescue. Now, we started off on the first lesson talking just a little bit about the grandeur of the God of the universe. What would you say about somebody who deliberately declared war on a God like that? You know, you've got to be insane, right? What hope has a human being got of fighting against the Almighty and coming out ahead? It's pathetic. But that's what Israel were trying to do. And when God turns against you, there is no hope of deliverance. The day of hope for Israel had gone. And this northern kingdom of Israel, the 10 tribes, in Hosea's lifetime, just a matter of maybe 20 years after he said this, disappeared and have never yet reappeared. The nation that we call Israel today is not the Israel of Hosea's day. It is the Judah of Hosea's day. Let's pray together.